This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 25 years ago, Actors Theater of Charlotte started small, but over the years it has steadily built a reputation for quality, thought-provoking, cutting-edge comedies and dramas. And they've opened their 25th anniversary season with a cutting-edge musical. If you thought our politics today is childish and obstructive, you ain't seen nothing until you go back to the time of bloody, bloody Andrew Jackson.
An explanation of the corrupt bargain which took place in the back halls of Washington while no one was watching.
John Calhoun says,
we need to find a scheme to keep the power in the hands of the chosen few.
John Quincy Adams says,
if my dad was president, I should get to be president too.
Henry Clay says,
I'll make you president if you make me Secretary of State.
Alexis de Tocqueville says something.
Silly? Yes. Irreverent? Oh, yeah. But does it hit the nail on the head while fitting in with Actors Theater's 25-year reputation? You bet.
All you educated people, you can talk of liberty, but do you really want the American people running their own country?
Oh, they're just getting started on this history lesson.
John Quincy Adams says,
if we steal the election, then Jackson will surely cave.
John Calhoun says,
you can be president if you don't try to take away.
Henry Clay says,
you'll get Missouri cause I know how to play real politic.
James Madison said something prescient about this, but he was kind of a let's dance.
Well, that song is about the corrupt bargain, which most of us don't remember, but it was when the House of Representatives handed the presidency to John Quincy Adams, despite the fact that Andrew Jackson had won both the popular and the electoral vote. Not pretty, but then to modernize, neither is Andrew Jackson, who would go on 4 years later to become president, to found the Democratic Party, conduct the first citizen polls, and to consolidate power in the executive branch, and become the subject of an American musical, truly the crowning achievement for him. And here to talk about that and about 25 years of producing theater is Dan Shoemaker, Actors Theater of Charlotte's founding executive director, and Chip Decker, the company's artistic director and the director of Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson. Welcome back to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson, the nation's seventh president, is cast as a rock star maverick who looks good in skinny jeans.
Looks great in skinny jeans.
So why did you choose this to open the 25th season?
It starts the season off with a bang, and we wanted to do something very special for our 25th birthday party, basically. And what better way to have a birthday party than to do something a little irreverent about this nation in itself, and it's just a great show.
In the musical 1776, the founding fathers are knocked off their pedestal in a kind of more gentle manner. And, of course, Andrew Jackson is not a founding father, although some of them appear or are referenced in this. But, I mean, who would have thought that there would be a musical number about the corrupt bargain of, what, 1824, it's a rock musical.
Yes.
And yet you're recommending that people under 17 stay away.
Well, even in the song clip that you played, you bleeped out.
Yes.
Bleep. We caution people. There is adult content and language in this show.
Which is not unusual for you.
Not unusual for us, no, not at all.
And that you kind of pushed the envelope over the years at Actors Theater with things like language and content, the topics of the plays.
Yes.
that you do. Well, Dan, you were there at the beginning. That was the intent, wasn't it? Was one of the intents.
Well, the main intent was to provide the local region with bold and innovative new work. At the time, this was 1988, there were only like a couple of theater companies in town. Charlotte Rep was predominantly a summer theater at the time. Mm-hmm. Then there was a CPCC summer theater, and then what was known as the Little Theater Charlotte, which is now Theater Charlotte. But in 1988, several of us who were regarded by the media as renegades from the old Golden Circle Theater were debating that issue one night after a production in Matthews. And as most people involved in theater do, afterwards you gather at a local pub and share stories. And at the time, it was discussed that this is what's needed in Charlotte. So we all decided, yeah, that's what's needed. And then someone said, well, why don't we do it? And someone said, well, yeah, why not? So that was the beginning of Actors Theater.
You said the media classified you as renegades.
Well, it was the print media classified us as renegades.
Who was writing reviews for theater then at the
event? Gosh.
That's prior to Tony Brown.
It was. This was 1988, and I don't remember, to be honest with you, exactly.
So when you say renegades, were you regarded with disdain, or were you regarded with, well, this is something that's kind of cool that's happening, but they are breaking away from something that is conservative?
I think it was breaking away from the conventional type of theater, which was mainly safe and predictable.
So did the media, meaning the Observer, because I think this is prior to Creative Loafing.
It was, yes.
And of course, radio and television didn't cover theater at all back then. Was it regarded as a positive thing, or was it, or were you?
No, it was.
Did they hold their nose?
I'm not sure about that, but we regarded it as a very positive thing.
Well, yes, you did. You're a renegade. I'm talking about them.
I'm not really sure, Mike, but I just remember that was the wording of the introduction.
It just strikes me that the bloody, bloody Andrew Jackson is another good reason to put it at the top of your 25th season, is that he was a renegade. He really changed the face of the presidency. He was the seventh guy in the office, and he was the people's president. He opened the doors of the White House on Inauguration Day, nearly wrecked the place, kept polling the American people to see what they thought, much to the chagrin of the people around him who really didn't want the rabble ruling the country, and the rabble being us, the people. So that seems like a fitting play to open your rabble-rousing organization with their 25th season, Joe.
It is a nice correlation there. Yeah, absolutely. He was the country's first rock star, a political rock star for sure, and the likes of which we haven't seen since until Obama, quite honestly. There's a lot of parallels, I think, between his tenure in office and the current presidency.
What are they?
Well, I mean, they dealt with so many similar issues. You have for Jackson, it was he feared the banks, and he knew that the National Bank at the time was a bad thing, and he fought to tear it down. Much like now today, we're dealing with too big to fail, where we just have, you know, banks are becoming so enormous, and that's not necessarily a good thing. You could kind of draw a correlation in immigration reform, what we're facing now. Only then, it was the immigrants who are pushing out the Native Americans, right. And now it's the Native Americans who are pushing out the immigrants. So there's a lot of parallels. Yeah.
And the New York Times, when this ran first off Broadway and then moved to Broadway, the New York Times said that there is no show in town that more astutely reflects the state of this nation today. Now, that was several years ago. That's still true, though, isn't it?
excuse me. I think it's more, as this presidency has gone on with these times and the resurgence of populism, I think it's even more apt now than it was when it came out in 2006.
Now, this is a musical, and it is a comedy, and it's a rock musical, and there's a song in there called Rockstar, where Andrew Jackson is referred to as a rock star. I was going to play part of it, but I would have to – my little bleeping button would have to go off all the time in that one. How would you describe how Andrew Jackson is portrayed in Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson?
Like you said earlier, he's a maverick. He's looked at – he's portrayed as a child, basically, who was influenced greatly by his father, which is a misnomer because actually in real life his father had died before he was born. But we get to see that he's very spoiled. He's really bratty. And if he can't get things done his way, then he has little fits, little tantrums, which really kind of reflects how when he grew up, that's his presidency. You know, if he wanted to do something and Congress said no, he said, well, I've got a gun and we're going to do it my way anyway, or I'm going home.
How much of that is based on fact?
The show takes some liberties with history.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I was going to add, because some directors like to actually read the history books when they're directing shows about historical figures, even though the script may not have certain facts, they feel they need to fill their heads with the real stuff. Did you feel the need to do that with a musical?
I did. I wanted to find out exactly what was real and what wasn't real. And the more I read about it, the less I wanted to read about it. I was like, this is a weird take on history. So some of the facts are true. He did have a father.
And he did wear skinny jeans.
And he did wear skinny jeans.
Was censured by Congress. So.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
So this is the first of three musicals that you're putting on the stage out there this year. You do five shows a year. Right? Is that right?
Yeah, we're doing seven this year.
Oh.
Yeah, with the inclusion of the earlier show, Narrow Daylight, which was the winner of our New Voices Festival last year. So we're actually doing seven productions this year.
That's another example of how you've grown, because I think you started out, doing three or four per season?
First season was three.
Mm-hmm.
And then
and that was
three, four, it was.
Mm-hmm. What's it like doing seven?
It's a struggle.
Nothing's changed.
Nothing's changed.
So this is the first of three musicals that you're doing. You're closing the year with a musical called Passing Strange, and sandwiched in between is a reprisal of a show you've done, I think, once or twice.
Three times. Yeah.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch, back by popular demand. There was a time when you guys rarely did musicals. Are you moving toward that more often for a reason, or is it just this 25th anniversary?
No, we've always tried to find whatever the most current exciting new musicals were, you know, like Hedwig and Trailer Park, Evil Dead the musical. So when they're available, we love to do them now.
Please note that Sound of Music was not on that list. You find the most bizarre – Bat Boy. You find the most bizarre musicals, but they're always – cool.
Right.
That's the objective?
That's the objective, yeah. We've got a brand new one, Hot from New York, for next year, I think. Can I talk about that?
Sure.
It's a little ditty called Cougar the Musical.
I wonder what that's about.
You know what it's about.
Now, I've never heard of that.
No, well, it's about three 50-something ladies who are now cougars, uh-huh. And they're out on the prowl. So it's doing extraordinarily well off Broadway right now, and we're going to be one of the first companies to do it outside of New York.
Are you just pandering to your audience?
No.
So take us back to the beginning. It was 25 years ago. It was you and Janet Eisenhart. Were you the people at the table at that restaurant deciding this is what Charlotte needed?
Or were there two of them.
Two of them.
Yeah, there were five of us that infamous night.
And how did you come together? Because the two of you have personalities. They're very different, you and Jim.
Yeah, well, we were all involved in the Golden Circle Theater at that mm-hmm. time, and we were involved in a Thanksgiving production of an obscure play called To Grandmother's House We Go, which how I remember that, I have no idea. Anyway, so we were just sitting around one night talking about the fact that that there was a need for a theater in Charlotte that specialized in new contemporary work.
And you also decided there was a need to pay the actors. That's almost blasphemy.
Isn't that unique?
Pay the
actors?
What, are you mad?
Wow. Yeah, that was another interesting aspect of that.
How much did you pay them back then?
At that time, I think it was about a couple of hundred for the run of the show.
See, people going to get rich in the acting business in Charlotte. Dan Shoemaker is with us. He's the founding executive director of Actors Theatre, and Chip Decker is artistic director and the director of their opening show of their 25th season, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. In concert with the Indigo Girls, the Grammy-winning duo performs majestic harmonies with an infectious blend of folk, pop, and rock, October the 5th in the Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. And Surgical Specialists of Charlotte, welcoming general and fellowship-trained colorectal surgeon Dr. Fuang Nguyen, performing laparoscopic and da Vinci robotic surgery. Details at sscLT.com. The Arab Spring held the promise of a new Middle East, more democratic, less prone to violence, but the opposite seems to have happened. Long, smoldering tensions were given the opportunity to flame up again, the unrest in Syria and Egypt, two cases in point. Davidson College's Dr. Jonathan Berkey says all of this can be traced to the Middle Ages, and that by looking back, we can get a clearer view of the future, and we'll try to peer into that future and back into the past Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the aftermath of the Navy Yard shooting, the Fed unexpectedly continues its stimulus program, and House Republicans try again to defund the health care law.
That's 2 hours of the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Join us from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks here on listener-funded public radio. We're 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dan Shoemaker and Chip Decker are with us. They're Actors Theater's major domos, and they're beginning their 25th anniversary. Actually, their 25th anniversary season is underway. But 25 years is a long time to be in business, particularly for a theater company in a town like Charlotte. When you look back and the fact that you're still here 25 years later, what goes through your mind? This is a significant milestone, a significant
It is. You know, whenever we first started, we had no idea that this was going to happen. We just felt like we were filling a void. But as we started to fill that void, we started to look ahead, and we started getting support from the community, support from individuals, and then it just started to look as if we had something we could build on.
Why do you think that happened? Because there have probably been at least 25 theater companies in those 25 years that have come and gone. And some of them were pretty good, and some of them did significant work for a while, and then just one day they just closed up shop. You were somehow able to continue trucking on.
I think one of the main reasons, Mike, is because, as I say, we knew we had something that that could probably last. So we knew that
Charlotte Rep.
We needed to get support. And as our support grew, we felt like that, you know, we've got something here. So we started to get that support from individuals. Then we started to organize a supportive board. And with that came donors and patrons, and then it just started to build from there.
Was there a roadmap? Did you have a goal like where you are today in mind when you started, or was it simply the goal of producing new works that no one else was doing?
Well, the first few years, it was just a goal of producing new work. And then, to say, as we saw the support building, then we knew that we were on to something. Mm-hmm. So you know, our first venture was here at Spirit Square, upstairs in the old acting studio.
No. Is that true?
Yeah.
Wasn't it Afro-American?
Well, I mean, that was our first production.
Production, okay.
But our first season was done here in 1990. But our first show was actually at the African-American Cultural Center. This was in 1989. And it was
Snake handlers.
Then, yeah.
And you had real snakes.
Live snakes.
And not just people who were money people. These are actual snakes.
Actual snakes. It was a show called, a play called Holy Ghost, written by Romulus Linney, who you've had on your show before.
Laura Linney's father, right?
Exactly. Whenever we did, A Lesson Before Dying. But anyway, that was our first show, and it was about a...
Why was that your first show? Because it was about a charismatic religious figure and his followers, and they were snake handlers.
They were.
And you used live snakes. What were you trying to say with that first show?
What we were trying to say was, this is bold, this is innovative, it's adventurous, join us. And so people did join us in the audience, but I don't think they were really quite ready for that, because the crates with the snakes were brought out, and these were not poisonous snakes, but we had sound coming out of the crates that resembled rattlesnakes. So when the boxes opened and the snakes came out, bing, people bolted for the door, and it was fun to watch. It was fun to watch, really. But that was in 1989, and then whenever Spirit Square was renovated in 1990, we did our first season upstairs in the old acting studio, which was a 60-seat black box.
Yeah, it's a dance studio now, and it's tiny.
Very tiny.
It's amazing that anybody could do anything in there.
Well, it was 60 seats, so... Yeah.
That shows you some of the challenges that theater companies anywhere face. You want to be able to produce shows that people want to see, and you want to do them at a level that shows that you know what you're doing and that it makes it worth coming back for the next production, and to do that in a black box, which is not really a theater, is remarkable.
We thought so, but Spirit Square management at the time believed in us, believed in what we were doing, and we were like a small resident company here. And then in 1994, whenever the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center opened, Charlotte Rep, which at that time was performing downstairs here in the Duke Energy Theater, moved over to the Performing Arts Center, which left that space open. Mm-hmm. So in 1994, we moved down to the Duke Energy Theater and was there from 1994 until 2004.
And one of the things that you have done historically, Chip, aside from direct and occasionally appear, is that you're the technical guru behind all this. You're a set designer, a lighting designer as well, and working in all these strange – now that you have your own theater, it's a different situation, I'm sure, because you know all the ins and outs. But when you're working in a place like the Duke Energy Theater where you're not – allowed to leave the lights up between productions, they have to take them all down. What kind of challenges did that provide?
The management back then was a lot different. So we got to know them very well and vice versa. So they would let us come in and the lights were left on the grid. And about the biggest challenges were we had a very tiny office upstairs. Very, very tiny when smoking was still allowed in buildings, if you can imagine that. We had a storage unit on the very far south side of town, and more than once sets were painted and built in my garage, much to the chagrin of my wife, who had to park her car in the driveway. So the challenges were basically loading in and setting up and tearing down.
And in 2004, you moved to the old Reliable Music Building on Stonewall, which has been your home ever since then. People today just know it as Actors Theater, and mm-hmm. it's your own space. You know what it's all about. What has that meant for you as a company and for your audiences?
I think the main thing is its identity. And that's one thing that a lot of theater companies don't have whenever they're vagabonds and going from space to space to space. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been one of the main reasons for our success there is the fact that that people identify Actors Theater on Stonewall Street.
Yeah, you've been able to do it. Cast has been able to do it. I suppose you could argue that the Charlotte Rep did it when they moved into the Booth Playhouse. That kind of became their theater, but it wasn't their theater. It was the Performing Arts Center's theater, and the production costs there were enormous. How were you able to do that? Well, most theater companies never achieve that.
Well, one of the main ways we were able to do it was through the support of patrons, mainly in the beginning, Mike and Kathy Mulvaney and George Sella were very supportive of us and helped us get into our new facility. And it was interesting because whenever we came in, Chip and his crew had to go in and completely and totally dismantle everything in the space. And we've got old footage of a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, taking it all the way down to the very walls and then rebuilding it. And for those of that remember the old Reliable Music, it was just solid wood, solid blonde wood. Mm-hmm. And then from then to now, the transformation has been phenomenal.
When you look back on 25 years of productions, what are some of the productions that stand out to you?
One of our main productions that we're really excited about was a new play that we commissioned in 2008 entitled Southern Rapture, mm-hmm. by Eric Coble. Eric came down and was an integral part of that. Incidentally, his new play, The Velocity of Autumn, is headed for Broadway in the spring. Ah. But anyway, Chip directed Southern Rapture, and we approached Eric about the concept, and I'll let Chip kind of take it from there. But Eric was very interested in the concept, and so Southern Rapture was was the beginning.
It's kind of odd because you have taken the place of Charlotte Rep, kind of, in this town, although that was not your intent, but you have. And Southern Rapture, it was about a play about a production that many would argue led to the downfall of Charlotte Rep.
I don't think we've replaced Charlotte Rep. I don't think anybody's ever going to replace Charlotte Rep or be able to. I mean, they had their own unique perspective on theater, and what they did was amazing. And we strive just to do the best that we can for the town. they did a production of Angels in America. And as anybody that knows the history of this area knows, it blew up. It was an amazing production, amazing performances. But it went national for all the wrong reasons.
And sold out, by the way.
And sold out every single moment it had. But it struck me as very funny in the aftermath of just how on both sides of the story people were so excited about it for all the – you know, we were – If you hated it, you hated it vehemently, and if you loved it, you loved it vehemently. And the more we loved or hated it, the further we got in apart in our talking. And then it just actually became very funny to me how ridiculous both sides of the conversation became. And one day I just woke up and I was just like, we've got to do a comedy about this, because when you get right down to it, this is pretty funny. It was certainly
a comedy of errors.
Comedy of errors, yeah. For sure. And nobody involved in it at the time, it wasn't funny.
No.
But that makes good comedy is when we can step away and look at it through a different eye. So we knew Eric Coble from a couple productions, and he had come down, and we were like, Eric, what do you think about doing this little riff on the whole Angels in America brouhaha? And he loved it, and he came to town and interviewed a bunch of the key players, and next thing you know, Southern Rapture was born.
Yeah, and they were the equity company in town. Now you are the equity company in town. And now this play, Angels in America, is about to be done by one of your rivals. Mm. Do you think they'll have the same kind of pushback that the rep got?
let me say one thing. I don't think we have rivals.
Okay.
I'd like to think that the theater community as a whole is much more supportive of each other. I what's good for cast is good for Actors Theater and vice versa, and for Theater Charlotte and for Carolina Shakespeare. We're all trying to engage and enlighten and inform our audiences, and we do that collectively. So I don't like the term rivalry.
Right.
I think we're definitely a cohesive partnership. Yeah. But to answer the question, I don't think they're going to get the pushback because we've moved past it as a city. Mm-hmm. But I still hope a lot of people that didn't go see it for whatever reason go and see it, because it is a great production, and I know they're going to do a great job with it.
Actors Theater is also notable, has been for over the years, for some of the plays that you have produced with African-American themes and storylines. Your 2006 production of Crowns, I think, is a good example, because you brought it back.
That's right.
Once again, because of popular demand. You even held it over the first time, and it's mm-hmm. become kind of a tradition of producing these plays. Talk about that. How did that happen for you?
I think that happened the play I mentioned earlier, A Lesson Before Dying. Mm-hmm. And we were just talking with several folks in the community about that play. And from there, it just seemed that there was an interest in plays that mainly had an African American theme, and then from there we did, as I say, the A Lesson Before Dying, and then Crowns, and then August Wilson's Jim of the Ocean, mm-hmm. and this season we're doing a new play by Lynn Nottage called By the Way, Meet Vera Stark. Which is an interesting play. It's the first part is like a 30s screwball comedy. The second part is just a little bit more dramatic, and it's about how African American actors were treated in the 1930s, and then the progress that's been made. So we're very, very proud of the fact that we can do these plays. We also connected with Charles Randolph Wright and have done several of his plays. And Charles just directed Motown the Musical on Broadway. So we've got those kinds of connections, which are always beneficial.
Yeah, when you look at the season ahead, something that really stands out is that they're all either Tony Award nominees or winners, or they're written by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwrights like Lynn Nottage, who you just referred to. But you've got Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. Then coming up, I believe next, is a comedy called Venus in Fur, which is the 2012 Tony Award winner for Best Play. What's that about?
Venus in Fur is basically a riff on the old novel Venus in Furs, and it's where the term sadomasochism originated in the original book. So essentially, a young
right up your alley.
That's right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Pain. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So a young ingenue actress arrives very late for an audition, and the director is over it, and he wants to go home. And she, her name is Wanda, but she pronounces it Vonda, just like the character in the book. And it parallels the book pretty closely, but it's a power story where in the beginning the director holds all the power over these young actors, but she turns the tables about two-thirds of the way through, and it becomes this – it is a comedy, but it's highly sexually charged and very provocative and intriguing. And the way she turns the tables is – it's a thriller. It's a comedic thriller is what it is.
Then in addition to the reprisal of Hedwig and the play Meet Vera Stark, you have the 2012 Best Play nominee Other Desert Cities, which is about quickly.
Other Desert Cities, basically, it's family. The title comes from signs that say, you know, up ahead it's Palm Springs, and Other Desert Cities is where the title comes from. But you have a family, and a daughter comes back, and she's got some secrets about the family they don't want spilled, and she decides that she's going to write a tell-all novel about it. And then, of course, the very Republican side of the family is like, you cannot talk about this publicly. And she's like, oh, well, I'll be darned. I'm going to talk about it.
I have a feeling – I don't know anything about Passing Strange. I've heard of it. It was a 2008 Tony Award winner for Best Book for a Musical. That you're closing the season with that. Tell me.
Passing Strange is a – it happened in 2008, which is like this black hole for theater because of the recession, but it was won many awards, and it's just a brilliant musical. The guy that wrote it, Stu, actually refers to it as the musical for people who hate musicals. It's rock, it's pop, it's R&B, it's jazz, it's blues, it's church, it's gospel. It's just an amazing – basically, it's the artist's journey and to discover oneself. All African-American cast. I discovered it by watching a Netflix video done by Spike Lee, actually filmed the production. And if for people that like to watch movies, this is by far the best stage-to-film version of a show, because he didn't try to adapt the show. He just filmed it. He filmed it over 3 days with 14 cameras, and it's brilliant. And I watched it, and I was just shaking at the end of it. And I was like, I don't care how we do it. This play needs to be done. This musical needs to be done.
And it will be at the end of the season at Actors Theatre of Charlotte on Stonewall. I think you are now the longest-running professional theater company in Charlotte, perhaps in history, Charlotte history, are you not?
Very quickly. I think you're right.
I think I am. Dan Shoemaker, the founding executive director, and Chip Ducker, the artistic director. Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson through October the
5th.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and dermatology, laser, and vein specialists of the Carolinas, welcoming Dr. Olson and Dr. Kazari to the practice, providing state-of-the-art skin care to the Charlotte region. Details at carolinaskin.com. And James McElroy and Deal, a law firm helping individuals and businesses avoid problems, overcome obstacles, and minimize consequences for over 50 years. JMDLaw.com. It's Friday, the weekly news roundup. The National Hour first at 10, the International Hour at 11 on the Diane Rehm Show. Guest host Steve Roberts is in for Diane. The aftermath of the shooting at the Navy Yard, the Fed's unexpected decision to stick with its stimulus program, and House Republicans trying again to defund the health care program, Obamacare, which begins registration on October the 1st. Those stories and more, part of the discussion coming up at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes. When we come back, women's intercultural exchange and mentoring.
Hi, this is Guy Raz. You have the opportunity to help shorten WFAE's fall pledge drive. Every $55,000 listeners contribute will buy back a day of the fund drive. So please go to WFAE.org, select the Contribute Now tab, and make your pledge. You can help reduce the number of days of the WFAE pledge drive and help pay for the news and information you depend on. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Several years ago, a social capital benchmark study revealed that the Charlotte region needed to build social capital and foster interracial trust if it was to become a truly national city. As a result, the Women's Intercultural Exchange was founded in 2005 to help bridge the social chasm separating women of different races, backgrounds, and cultures. That effort continues and includes mentoring across race and difference. Joan Zimmerman, CEO of Southern Shows. They produce the Southern Women's Show, the Southern Christmas Show, the Southern Spring Show. And Stephanie Counts, both founded the Women's Intercultural Exchange, of which Stephanie is now CEO. And both join us for the remainder of the hour. Welcome, both of you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thank you. One quick thing, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't found it. Dee Dixon and Stephanie found it. And I was a co-chair, which I'm still delighted to be part of it.
Well, you learn something new every day.
Yeah.
And that's why I do the show.
I don't want...
That's okay. How did this come to be then? Talk to me, Stephanie, how this actually came into fruition.
Well, Mike, in 2004, late 2004, Dee Dixon and I did a study. It was called What Women of Color Want. We brought 100 women together of color, African-American, Asian, Hispanic. We had a large group, and we wanted to find out what the nuances of these women were. Since they weren't sitting at the corporate table, we wanted to find out why and what their issues were around marketing, health, lifestyle, finance, and those kinds of things. And what we discovered, along with, as you said, the social capital study, there were some major trust issues with women of color and Caucasian women. We found that our results showed that there was only a 22% level of trust from our study.
So when you did the study and when you sat around that table with women of color,
mm-hmm.
was it that they didn't trust the white men and women in the business world, and was the same true in the opposite direction?
Well, we didn't. On that occasion, we were only looking at women of color. And yes, that was the result of that they did not, they had a low level of trust, but it actually reflected the social capital study
mm-hmm.
because in our city, we ended up coming out 39 out of 40 in terms of racial trust.
So Joan Zimmerman, how did a white woman get involved in all of this?
Because Stephanie Counts asked me to get involved, and you do not say no to Stephanie. But it's interesting, when Stephanie asked me to be involved, I thought, I don't really need this. I understand it. I've been around since the 60s, you know, and all of this. But once I got involved with the Women's Intercultural Exchange, I really had some eye-opening experiences. And we started being very intentional about looking. Who's involved in this? Who's involved in that? We would have black tie dinners. I would get a table. We would have the only diverse table in the room. And it was really interesting once you started to observe that even though we were very equal and very open with each other at work
mm-hmm.
and in the marketplace, when it came to social involvement, it was not happening.
Is it happening today?
It's happening more, and I think it's happening because of groups, well, particularly because of Women's Intercultural Exchange. The trust level, which you talked about earlier, was surprising to me because these women of color were educated women. They were CEOs. They were brilliant women. But they didn't trust me. And I thought, why not? And then I realized we came at everything from just totally different perspectives.
Right. And that's why we felt it was we brought our Caucasian sisters to the table to share the results of this study with them. And they were passionate about finding out why and what we can do. And we decided that that was going to be our central focus, women building trust across race and culture.
One of the other components of this, I understand, is mentoring.
Mentoring.
Where did the idea that this needed to happen come from, and how did it begin? How do you I'm not sure how to ask the question, but some people who need mentoring don't know that they need mentoring.
Right.
Other people crave it, but they don't know who to go to. So how did that happen?
Well, one of the things that we've tried to do is to build our programs around the research and the feedback that we get, and mentoring always came to the top. And then when we really got into it and worked with the International Mentoring Association, we found out that the most successful mentoring relationships were across difference. And I think that's pretty obvious why, because we bring our experiences to the table and our cultural differences. So that's how we did a conference called Mentoring Across Difference, launched with students at the various universities first, but we also found that the people within the organization ended up mentoring each other.
This seems like a potential minefield, particularly if you've never done it before, and if you've just gotten the idea that this needs to be done, because if there's a limited trust among mm-hmm. different people of different backgrounds, black, white, whatever the differences are, why would you accept what a mentor says to you if you don't trust them? Because they may be planting little seeds for failure in your mind.
I think that's the big thing about this organization. You develop the trust. And you don't just suddenly sit in a room with someone and tell them everything you know. You listen first to their where they're coming from. And I have 5 mentors, all of different races, they still stay in touch with me. We still communicate back and forth. So it's the trust that you build up. And I think that is the magic ingredient of WIE.
You have 5 mentors?
Mentees.
Or 5 mentor,
mentees. Sorry,
okay.
I am okay. Mentor to 5 individuals.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And it's great. They teach me a lot. You know, in our shows particularly, we had a very difficult time attracting a diverse exhibitor base and attendee base. That doesn't happen anymore because with the help of groups like WIE, specifically WIE, we know who to go to, who to help. It's just so obvious once you're part of it.
Absolutely. And what we do, Mike, to help to build this trust is every conference, every seminar that we do, we look through the lens of race and culture. For instance, if we do a finance workshop, we actually have representatives of various ethnicities coming from their perspective on finance. And what happens is that you learn from each other.
Explain that to me. Money is money, numbers are numbers. So how can there be a difference in money and numbers from a racial or a gender or a life background perspective? Why is there a different perspective, I guess?
Who has the money? Who doesn't have the money? Why don't they have it? One of the things that we did in a workshop that we did a couple of years ago at Queens University, we had an African-American woman from Catalyst who looks at particularly at diversity and inclusion. And what she shared with the audience, and people were shocked, that the GI Bill, African-American men, did not reap the results of the GI Bill in the same way that others did.
Why not?
Does that, well, okay. Those were the policies of the time, and people didn't know that. So does that help you understand the history and why people of color did not have the same homes, you know, opportunities to buy homes and to do those kinds of things? So that's what we learned.
So what kinds of mentoring? I'm sorry, John, you wanted to.
No, I was going to say back to the social capital mm-hmm. and back to the very first group that we put together and presented ourselves as a diverse group at a black tie special all women's event. The second year we went, there were 5 tables. They come to you and say, "We are so embarrassed that this happened. Next year, it will be different."
Mm-hmm.
So everything has been very intentional. It's not being forced, but it's been intentional that we spread the word, this is how the world is, and this is how we need to be in Charlotte. And people respond. Mm. They do respond.
What kind of mentoring have you found is needed, if that's a fair question?
Well, in my particular case, it's been business. How do we start the business? How do we reach out into your community, mm-hmm. my community, and how do we do our balance? Everything. If they're usually entrepreneurs, they're small business people, they have cleaning services, they have catering services, they have different small businesses. So in my case, it is definitely business.
Mm-hmm.
And I help them in every way.
Stephanie?
Well, we currently are working with university students, particularly juniors and seniors. We had a great conference yesterday, and one of our former mentees spoke, and she said it was a life-changing experience mm-hmm. because she was getting the academic piece, but she wasn't getting the world piece. You know, her mentor was able to expose her to various opportunities so that she would be successful in her next steps in life. So we are concentrating on the universities with a group called Vision 2020, a woman's group that is collaborating for 2020, which is the 19th, when the 19th Amendment 100 years ago, allowing women to vote. And they are coming up with all kinds of projects to make sure that women are treated equally.
Mm-hmm. In your program, the mentoring also includes, I'm told, educating women of different races and backgrounds about each other. What have the two of you discovered? Because I know that the two of you work closely together. What have the two of you discovered about each other?
Well, one of the first things that that we do, we go deep. I think I think that there are many relationships that are friendly but surface. And I think that the fact that Joan has been so candid with me about. And she probably would be a person that would be considered, you know, really all-knowing about this area. And the fact that she's been so candid with me about what she's learned and what she didn't know, or she might have known but wasn't aware of it. And that's always helpful, because that helps us to know where our targets are and what we need to, you know, to concentrate on, I guess. So I've learned more about her in terms of what happened during the years when we were really fighting to make sure that we were together and integrated and, you know, socially aware and working with each other. And she has really shared with me, you know, how important this organization is, has been to her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it is. And of course, what I've learned is that we're not different. We are very much the same, Stephanie and I. And we just had not come together in the different social circles. And it's the social circles that really, really need warming up and improving in the city. We're great in business. I mean, we really are. I mean, we've come a long, long way. But I have learned from Stephanie that we are all, as they say, sisters under the skin, and it's been a great experience. It's been life-changing for me.
We have come a long way, but we have a long way to go, it seems to me. And people forget, because we have really short-term memories in America for some reason, forget that it wasn't that long ago when there was not a seat at the table, period. You couldn't even get in the door, much less sit at the table,
exactly,
if you weren't the right skin color or the right background. I just moderated this discussion at the Harvey Gantt Center with Bernard Kinsey and the Kinsey Collection, and Tom Hanchett, about two people of relatively the same age, growing up at the same time, in completely different worlds. Bernard Kinsey, the African-American gentleman, said he was in his 20s before he ever really saw a white person, because they lived in a neighborhood that was completely self-sufficient. They didn't need anybody from the outside, and the same is true in the opposite direction. And we've come along, and that was just a few years ago.
Yeah, that was not. In fact, my first eye-opening experience, which made me very, very open to WIE and eager to be a part of it, came in Nashville from John Siegenthaler, who you probably know, USA Today, Robert Kennedy.
Right.
We were presenting him for one of our shows, and he looked at our materials, and he said, "Joan, I can't be a part of this." And I said, "Why not?" Whoa. He said, "Because it's too lily white." I looked at our materials, and he was so right. I was so embarrassed. I said, "Give me 2 weeks, and I will come back and see if we can talk again." But it was like shocking to me that I hadn't seen that there was no inclusion in what we were doing.
You work with college-age young women, I believe. This organization does it.
The organization does, yes.
Are you seeing a different dynamic in them? Because this is a new generation.
Yes, it is. I think there are common threads, though, regarding the mentoring. I think there's always going to be a need for young women to have connections with women that have already well, I wouldn't say made it, but they've already crossed that line. They're working, they're making, helping them to make connections in the community and why it's important for volunteerism, that kind of thing. So I think that what I see happening now for us is the same thing, same needs that I would have had at the time that I was in college, to have a woman or man that could help me make that next connection for the next steps in my life. So I feel there's a lot of sameness.
There are stereotypes that we get from movies and television shows about women, and I'm curious as to whether or not you whether it's been your experience that women willingly help other women, or do they need to be prodded to help other women?
I think women willingly help other women. I personally believe that. Now, I know I hear stories of the upper levels of mega corporations mm-hmm. where there's not that kind of support. But I think the world is changing in general, and women are helping women. In fact, the conference yesterday, the keynote speaker focused primarily on that. And as she quoted Madeleine Albright, who said there's a special place in hell for women who do not mm-hmm. help and support other women. I think we're beyond. I think we help other women.
How much work remains to be done?
The reason I'm speechless is because I think that we've got lots to do. One of the things, and I don't know if we have time, but I wanted to say
20 seconds.
Okay, we need to build this relationship as not only trust is a business essential also. Mm-hmm. And we need to sell that to our corporations and organizations.
WIE is Women's Intercultural Exchange. Joan Zimmerman and Stephanie Counts are our guests talking about that. But there's also a website. Can I give it out?
Yes.
It's wi-ce.org. www.wi-ce.org. You can find out more about this and perhaps begin to participate in it. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.